indulge me for a minute. So I gave a couple possible titles, which is actually a little silly because I was going to talk about whatever I wanted to anyway. And I don't know if you know this, but Rosh Hashanah is coming, yes? And there are a lot of people that think that you have to wait for Rosh Hashanah, Yom Kippur, in order to do tshuva. The reality is that you're allowed to beat the holiday rush and to do it a little bit earlier. And that works as well. What we're going to do is we're going to look at a story that deals with tshuva. As soon as we're ready, I'm going to actually tell you what it is. So we all have a fantasy. Our fantasy is that all of us have, let's call it, an inalienable right to sin. And then whenever it is that we want, we can tell God, you know what, we were just kidding, and we're sorry, and now we want you to forgive us completely. Is that correct or is that not correct? Is there ever a point that you've gone and it's too far? And does God have the prerogative of saying, that's it, sorry? So there's actually two different Gemaras that I was thinking of that deal with this topic. And personally, I couldn't decide which one to do, so I gave the choice today. And one was chosen. And the problem with one is chosen is that it's long and it's going to take too much time, so I'm going to truncate it, and we're going to do it quicker than we should, which may leave you frustrated, so I apologize for that already. But my suspicion is that here's the main part of the story you happen to know. Now, there's actually two Gemarot, as I start to say, there's two Gemarot that somebody comes and says in the story, that's it, you can't do tshuva. Anybody know what those two Gemarot are? And the two people that tell them are really, really different people, which is what makes it really interesting. Did you ever think about the contrast between the two? So that's what makes it interesting. In one story, there was a so-called rabbi who really wasn't a rabbi, who the Gemara says, and I apologize for saying this, it says that he happened to have been intimate with every single prostitute in the world, which is probably an exaggeration, but not for lack of trying. And finally, he was with this one particular woman. And as he's with her, she laughs and she says to him, that, by the way, that was, her laughing is an editorializing on my part, but she does say to him, that's it, you can't do tshuva. Which, of course, what does he then do? Then he goes and the rest of the story is trying to do tshuva. So that's one story, and that's a story known of Rabbi Elazar ben Dordaya, and that's not the one we're going to talk about today. There's another story in the Gemara about somebody who's considered to be so notorious that for the most part, the Gemara won't even mention his name. It won't even say his name. I can tell you his name. His real name is Elisha ben Avuya. The Gemara calls him Acher, the other one. As I said, it's for some of you, that would be the one, how does that go? The one whose name, Kim?
He must not be named.
Excellent. So now I see that you're well-read. Not in Gemara, but you're well-read. So this is excellent. So that's who Elisha ben Avuya is. They can't even say his name. He becomes somebody else. He becomes Acher. So, to give a little bit of the background, and then, as I said, we'll get to the story. What we're told is that there were four rabbis. This is not a joke. I know it can start. There were once four rabbis. There were four rabbis, who, by the way, the Gemara is not even sure if two of them were indeed rabbis. They were a person named Rabbi Shimon ben Azai, a person named Rabbi Shimon ben Zoma, a person named Elisha ben Avuya, and the fourth one you all know, and that is Rabbi Akiva. It said that four of them got involved in some kind of experience which the Gemara calls parades. For all of you who are educated, show me who you are, that parades means Pshat, Remez, Rash, and Sod. Rashi's unaware of it, that that's what it means. None of the Rishonim are aware that that's what it means. In fact, what Rashi suggests that the word paradise is connected to Gan Eden, which means paradise means paradise. It means that the four of them, if we'll look at some of the more mystical commentaries, say that these were trying to go back to Gan Eden and to try to create some kind of tikkun to the very first sin that ever took place. What was the first sin that ever took place? Come on, you this you know. What's the first sin that took place? Eating from the Eitz Hadaat Tova Ra. What happens when you eat from the Eitz Hadaat Tova Ra? Well, one thing happens is, what happens? It's a very good question. What happens when you eat from it? Well, one is you realize you're naked. Second, what happens when you eat from it? Well, death comes into the world. What else happens when you eat from it? It causes confusion between Tov and Ra. It's Eitz Hadaat Tov and Ra. You are now going to get confusion between Tov and Ra. And now the whole world is going to be impacted by that type of confusion. So let's go back. The four of these rabbis go and they're trying to fix the basic sin which exists from the very beginning of time, but trying to enter into this paradise, trying to enter into this literally field, orchard, paradise, is very, very dangerous. Rabbi Akiva warns them before they go in, and we're not going to go into the whole warning, but we're told it does not work out well. One of the rabbis, Ben Azai, he enters and he dies. And my simple explanation for his death based upon Rashi is that he went to a place. Do you guys remember the movie The Wizard of Oz? Yeah. Remember the best scene in the movie? Not the scary scenes, the best scene in the movie. What was the absolute best scene in the movie? When it turns from black and white to color. Right. The whole thing, and all movies to that point were black and white. Everything is black and white. The world, listen, I doubt any of you from Kansas, but Kansas really is black and white. That's it. But the whole place is black and white. And then they get to this other place called Oz. Now the difference between Ben Azai and Dorothy is that Dorothy wants to go home. That's all that she wants, is she wants to go back home. On the other hand, Ben Azai doesn't want to go home. You know why? Because he's in a world of living, vivid color right now. But I'm saying that spiritually. He went to a place which is just so holy. He went up into heaven, and he sees heaven that he just can't begin to imagine to go down. So it says, Ben Azai looked, he saw something, and he died. The other one, Ben Zoma, we're told that he goes and he looks, and he comes back down, but his head is still in the clouds. He's disconnected to this world. He's involved in another world. Elisha ben Avuya goes up, and that's really the person we're going to study about, and something goes terribly wrong. We'll skip him for a moment. Rabbi Akiva, we're told, Ola v'shalom v'yorid v'shalom, or in some texts, Nichnas v'shalom v'yotza v'shalom. And the Maharsha explains that why was Rabbi Akiva yotze v'shalom? Why? Because he was Nichnas v'shalom. That means that Rabbi Akiva was whole, spiritually balanced, religiously balanced when he went in, and that's why he was okay coming out. On the other hand, Elisha ben Avuya was not as balanced. Now, just in case, again, we don't know that much about him. From what we see from other rabbinic sources, there was nobody as smart as him. There was nobody as talented as him. He was literally somebody who's on the same level with the Rabbi Akiva. They're contemporaries, and in some ways he may even have been more impressive. We're told, though, that when he goes up into paradise, he enters into heaven. That's what it is. He enters into heaven, Garden of Eden, Gan Eden. He gets up there, everything goes wrong. And then let me help you a little bit. Again, what the Gemara wants to tell us, and we'll read some of it. The Gemara is trying to tell you that if you think that being involved in some kind of mystical endeavor is going to solve all your problems, the opposite is true. You need to be well-balanced before being involved in this. And if not, it's going to magnify the problems that take place. Now, we're told that he goes up. And when he goes up, he sees, actually, it uses a metaphor. It says, Acher kotzeitz benetiot. In all later rabbinic and Hasidic literature, kotzeitz benetiot becomes a metaphor for losing one's faith. Literally, it means ripping out the plantings. The metaphor is paradise. Paradise means the Garden of Eden. Kotzeitz benetiot means that he ripped up the trees of the Garden of Eden. He uprooted the very basis of religion. So the Gemara says, what does that mean? So it says, here's what happened. He goes up into heaven. Now I'm going to ask you, if you're going to, what he sees, if you think should bring a religious crisis or religious confirmation. It says that he sees an angel, and the angel is sitting down and writing all of the good deeds of Israel. Somebody, a nice young woman, gives tzedakah. The angel, whose name is Metatron, writes it down. A young man puts on his tefillin. The angel writes it down. A young woman learns Torah. The angel writes it down. Every single deed which is done, the angel sits and writes it down. Now, would this cause for you a religious crisis or confirmation? So, that was a question. I think this is why I brought my wife. She's the only one who'll speak. She has no problem. Crisis or confirmation? Confirmation. But now I said, no, it's a setup. She knows the answer. Yes, you agree with me or disagree with me?
Yeah.
Yeah. Confirmation. This causes Felicia ben Avuya absolute religious crisis. And he says, basically what's bothering him is, why is the angel sitting? What's sapping the strength of the angel away? But by the way, the questions were dead. And then the Gemara says, Shema, Chas V'Shalom. Chas V'Shalom is not what he said. Chas V'Shalom is an editorial comment when the Gemara is telling over words of Kfira. Shema, Chas V'Shalom, Shtei Rishuyot. Maybe, God forbid, there's two different powers. What does two different powers mean? That maybe instead of there being one God, maybe there's two gods. But by the way, I'm going to say it again. Is this something which, when you read the Gemara, is there any hint to that? I'll help you. The answer is not. It seems to me that he had a religious crisis before he went up, and whatever he was going to see there, it was not going to work out. Now, here is what happens in very, very quick fashion. The angel is called to task, and the angel gets punished. Said, you saw a human being coming, why are you sitting down? And even ostensibly giving a person a reason to possibly make a mistake. And the angel receives 60 fiery lashes. It's called in Aramaic, and this is very famous for whatever reason, pulsa denura. You get 60 fiery lashes, but the angel is then given permission to rip up all of the good deeds of Elisha ben Avuya. Which means that Elisha ben Avuya is up in heaven, he sees angels, and suddenly, as he's there, as he has this mystical experience, he suddenly finds himself without any merit whatsoever in this world. Again, this is the angel in charge of writing the good deeds, which all of us, we learned, and this is one of the possible topics about the three books, or the two different books being opened on Rosh Hashanah. Here we have the books. This is it. This is the guy keeping the books. He's in charge of writing the books. But what's the one problem? The page, the entry that says Elisha ben Avuya, the angel Metatron is given permission to rip it out of the book, crumple it, throw it across heaven, land in the celestial garbage pail, and Elisha ben Avuya has no more merit. Okay, now one second. Do you all recognize that can ruin your day? Yes? So what do you do next? He then hears a voice. And the voice is as follows. First, I'll read the line before. It Yahaveh le reshuta lemimchat zadvata da'acher. He was given permission to wipe out all the good deeds of Acher. Yotzta bat kol. You know what a bat kol is? Yes?
Yes.
In Bnei Brak, they're so firm they won't listen to a bat kol because it's Kolisha. Yotzta bat kol. A bat kol comes out of heaven and says, Va'amra, and it quotes a pasuk in Yirmiyahu, Perakimu, Shuvu bonim shovavim. I'm in the middle of a sentence now. What do those words mean? Shuvu bonim shovavim. Who knows Hebrew? What's a shovav? What? Shovav is mischievous. The voice that says, Shuvu banim shovavim. Do you realize how tender that voice is? What a beautiful prophecy that is. My children who've been mischievous, God calls them back and says, come back, come back. You've ran away from home. You've done silly things. You've done things that would disappoint me. Shuvu banim shovavim. Return my mischievous children. But then the voice, that's a pasuk in Yirmiyahu, but then the voice continues and it says, chutz me'acher. Everybody come back home, not acher. Now, here's where our problem begins. Acher, we're then told, he says as follows, hoil the itrid le'lahu gavrimehu alma, since this person already lost his share in that world, because he's told not to come back, leave fukulahani behay alma. I may as well go and enjoy this world. Nafik acher l'tarbut ra'ah. He begins a life on the wild side. Literally, tarbut ra'ah means a bad culture, but he begins to live on the other side, as it were. Ashkach zona. He bumps into a prostitute. Tav'ah. He asked her, so how much is it? Amrele, and she says to him, Lav Elisha ben Avuya ata? Aren't you Elisha ben Avuya? As I said, he's a famous rabbi. His picture is up in all the falafel stores. She, right? You're Elisha, but it's not that she had a special price for rabbis. She says, aren't you Elisha ben Avuya? So what does it say? He ripped something out of the ground on Shabbat, and he, most likely it's a radish, and he hands it to her, and she says, Acherhu, he must be somebody else. Now, the story continues for a while. I'm not going to tell you the whole story. If you want, you could read it. There's a wonderful, terrible book. It's a wonderful book because it's really interesting. It's a terrible book because it acknowledges that it's fiction, but most students who I've met over the years who've been made to read it by their teachers never realize that it's fiction. The book is called As a Driven Leaf, and it's somewhat, as far as I can tell, autobiographical by the person who wrote it. And he sort of paints Acher as a very, very sympathetic figure. He was too smart for the other rabbis. He lost his faith. Who could, listen, not everybody can have faith. He lost his faith. But that's not really a fair description of Acher, because he ends up becoming somebody who's much more ominous. His whole sympathetic read of Acher is based on one passage, which is later on over here. He has a student who's very famous. His student is named Rebbe Meir. The irony is that Rebbe Meir and Acher come from two different places. Rebbe Meir, according to our tradition, was himself a convert, which means he starts outside of the Jewish world, enters in, while Acher starts in the Jewish community and ends up leaving the Jewish community. Rebbe Meir is not willing to give up on his teacher. And he keeps on speaking to him, and he keeps on learning with him, he keeps on trying, as far as I can tell, trying even to be makar of him and bring him back. During one, although Elisha ben Avuya is very dangerous, and if you would read the whole dialogue, if we were really to study it now, you would see that what he's really trying to do is to convince Rebbe Meir of dualism. He's trying to convince him that there really are two gods. And Rebbe Meir keeps on answering back and keeps on trying to show him that there's this truth of one God, and he doesn't get all that far. But at one point, and as I said, there's one sympathetic scene where Elisha ben Avuya is riding on his horse on Shabbat, and Rebbe Meir is walking next to him, and they're having a dialogue, which, by the way, is very important, but I'm skipping. And at some point, Elisha says to Rebbe Meir, that's far enough. He goes, what do you mean? He goes, you've gotten to the Tchum Shabbat, you can't go any further. So he says to him, why don't you come back? Why don't you do tshuva? And he says, I can't. Why can't I? He goes, I've already told you. I heard of the voice said to me, everyone can come back except for Elisha ben Avuya. And I'm going to say, or except for Acher. And that's our problem. Our problem is, does this really work? Is there really a situation that God says no? So I'm going to pause here. But the rest of the story in the Bavli is actually, and especially in the Bavli, because there's also a passage in Yerushalmi, the rest of the Bavli is actually quite interesting, because here's the part that Milton Steinberg skipped. It says, Rebbe Meir grabs him and says, you hear voices. Let's try something else. He takes him to a school, and there's a little kid learning. In the olden days, they believed that little kids have like the 60th of prophecy. And if you walk into a Beit Midrash, whatever the kid is learning right then may be some kind of a prophecy. Pulls him in, says to the kid, what are you learning? And the kid says something which is really ominous. Something to the effect that you can try to put on as much makeup as you want, but I can see right through it and see all of the ugliness of your sin. not a nice pasuk. Takes him to another school, asks another kid, another ominous verse, another one, another. Says he takes him to 13 different schools, and every single one of these kids said something ominous. The last one says, "Ularasha amar Elokim, lama l'saper chukai." To the wicked one, God said, "Why do you keep talking about my laws?" Except the 13th kid stuttered, and instead of saying "Ularasha," it came out when he stuttered, "Ula Elisha amar Elokim." God said to Elisha, "Why do you still talk about my Torah?" So there's two endings of the story. One ending is that Elisha ben Avuya had a knife on him, and he cut the kid up into 13 pieces and sent a piece of this kid to the 13 schools. The other ending is, he said, "It's a shame I don't have a knife on me, because if I had a knife on me, I'd cut you up and kill you." Not very nice. Now, I'm going to pause here again. Does it bother any of you that God would say to such a person, "Not for you"? Let me try something else. The people in this room, are we privileged?
Yes.
In what way? Are we religiously privileged? Yeah. He doesn't pay me for this. You go to a wonderful school. You're in Israel. Most of you, I presume, went to very good high schools. Most of you, I presume, come from religious families. You all realize there's lots of young Jewish women in this world who don't have this privilege, who were not brought up with this kind of information, who were not brought up in these kinds of families, who were not brought up going to these kinds of schools. Do you think that you're better Jews because you know more and do more than somebody who has less education?
No.
Do we have a right to judge?
No.
Do we have a right to judge and say, "This person does not know as much as me"? When he introduced me, so you realize that I have no right to be proud at all. I studied for 3 years with Rabbi Soloveitchik. I studied with Nechama Leibowitz. I studied with Rav Breuer. I studied for 4 years with Rav Lichtenstein. I can keep on going, other people that you may have heard of. So you know what? If I wouldn't know something in learning, when I get to heaven, I'd be in a lot of trouble. And it could be anyway I'm in trouble. Which means that knowledge becomes responsibility. Growing up in a certain type of family, and I'll say it again, and my father studied the Rabbi Soloveitchik for 40 years, and my brother was one of his closest students, and my brother was a student of Rabbi Lichtenstein for 30 years, and he's been teaching English for the last 25 years. So I'll say it again. So I have had certain privilege. Elisha ben Avuya had certain privilege. He was brought up in the best family. He studied with the best teachers. He went to heaven and he saw angels writing down that God rewards and takes notice of every single good deed that we did. After seeing all this, after all this privilege, should he still have the right to do tshuva? He's still saying yes. Why? Or should the standards be a little bit higher? So now, the commentaries have difficulty with this. They have difficulty. But I want to try to solve the whole thing by reading another source, which is the Yerushalmi's version of the story. And the Yerushalmi tells a worse story than we've already heard. The Yerushalmi starts right away and says, "Who's Acher?" So he says, "Acher? He..." Now, remember something. The Bavli in Bavel, here's the story secondhand. Do you realize where most of the story took place? It took place in heaven. In the Yerushalmi, it all takes place down here on earth. The Bavli is fascinated theologically. How could a man so great, a friend of Rabbi Akiva, totally lose his faith? And the Yerushalmi tells over another story, which, as far as I can tell, is a lot more historically, I'll say valid, but is much closer historically, geographically, and chronologically. The Yerushalmi says, "Who was Acher? Acher used to kill yeshiva students. Acher, he used to walk into the yeshiva, and if he saw students succeeding, he'd rip them out of the yeshiva and say, 'You go into another business. You become a carpenter. You become a tailor. You become, right, a smith.' And give them all jobs to do." But by the way, you can ask a simple, how do you get away with this? How is he able to do this? The next part of the Yerushalmi gives us the answer. The next part of the Yerushalmi says that the Romans made a decree the Jews were not allowed to keep Shabbat. Who was the advisor of the Romans telling them what to do? Elisha ben Avuya. A matter of fact, the Romans bring him out and said, take a look. And he saw two Jews carrying like a table like this, two Jews carrying a table together. And the Roman says, look, we're making them publicly desecrate Shabbat. What did Elisha ben Avuya say? He said, if two people are doing it together, then it's not asumi d'oraisa, it's only asumi d'rabbanan. Shnayim she'asua is only asumi d'rabbanan. He says they're not breaking Shabbos, they're only breaking it on a rabbinic level, not on a Torah level. Make each one of them carry it by themselves. He used his Torah knowledge to destroy Jewish faith. So then, each Jew would take it by himself, but they would carry it from inside the house and put it down in a karmelit. Any of you know what a karmelit is? Of course not. And neither did the Romans know what it is. But a karmelit is not considered to be a real reshut. So if you put it down, it's only us and midrabanan. So they said, look, the Jew, each one is doing by himself now. And he goes, no, they're putting down on a karmelit. And the Romans say, a karmelit, what? And he says, no, make each one of them put it to take it themselves and put it down in reshut. Rather, he teaches the Romans hilchot Shabbat so they can know how to demoralize the Jews and make sure they don't keep Shabbat properly. One second, you still sympathetic? He killed kids because he had the Roman soldiers with him. By the way, just notice the parallel. In the Bavli, he believes in two powers. What are the two powers? Dualism. In Yerushalmi, also believes in two powers. But the other power, we know exactly who it is. It's the Romans. Essentially, Elisha ben Avuya has a religious crisis when something happens. The temple gets destroyed, and he realizes there's something stronger than God in this world. By the way, you can agree with that formulation or disagree with that formulation. We would tend not to agree with that formulation. But he says to himself, why have I been wasting my time being Jewish all these years when, look, the Romans can just go and destroy the place? The fact that we had prophecies and prophets, at least the whole first temple period, warning us that if we don't behave, this is what's going to happen, and all we have to do is push the replay button to understand what happens by Bayit Sheni. And all of this fits into a theological category. All that doesn't make a difference. Elisha ben Avuya loses faith, and he tells us why. And again, the Yerushalmi then goes through dialogues between him and Rebbe Meir. And in these dialogues, Rebbe Meir keeps on pushing him and pushing him and pushing him. And finally he says, listen, something can only be fixed if it was good in its foundation. And my foundation is such that when I was born, on the day they made my brit, Rabbi Eliezer HaGadol, Rabbi Yeshua ben Chananya, were there by the brit. And they were waiting for the brit to start, and the two of them started talking in Torah, and the Torah was so intense that a fire surrounded them. And his father, Avuya, walked in and said, Rabbi, you're trying to burn down my house? Not a metaphor. Are you trying to burn down my house? And they said, sorry, that's the intensity of Torah from Har Sinai. And Avuya says, if my son makes it, if he lives, if he survives, I'm going to make sure he learns and make sure that he accesses the power of Torah. So once Elisha ben Avuya realizes there's something else with more power, he gives up. That's what happens. He gives up. There's something else with more power. A matter of fact, the Rishalmi, the bat kol that rings out says, although the bat kol is a little different, over here the Rishalmi tells the following. It says, once upon a time, on Shabbat, which happened to be Yom Kippur, he's riding on his horse, and he tramples the place that the Beit HaMikdash once stood. He tramples the place that the Holy of Holies once was, the Kodesh HaKodashim, and a voice comes out saying, Shuvu Banim Shovim. By the way, I'm going to ask you again the same question. If you were to go by the ruins of the Beit HaMikdash and hear a faint voice saying, my children, come back, Chutz min Elisha ben Avuya, Shayoda Kochi Umoradbi. He knew my power, and nonetheless he rebelled against me. And I'm going to say it again, it all comes down to power. So now, in the time we have left, I want to try to figure out, could he have done tshuva or not? There are those who claim, and this is more of a Hasidic interpretation, there are those who claim that he was lying. He never heard such a voice. He didn't feel like being religious. He said, I heard a voice. Go prove you heard a voice. Do you like that interpretation? I don't. Okay, you like it, it's good. By the way, if you like it, I can stop. I don't love that interpretation. Rabbi Soloveitchik, any of you aware of what he wrote about this or no? Yes, no, have you heard this? Any of you speak English, by the way? Okay, good. Rabbi Soloveitchik gave a series of talks, which was originally published in Yiddish, and it was called the Four Drashot. Later on, they found another one, and it was called the Five Drashot, and then they published it as the Rav Speaks, and I think they just published it again with another name. You don't have to write a lot of books. You write one book and keep changing the name. Definitely something to think about. Rabbi Soloveitchik has the most beautiful explanation of this. The only problem is I don't believe that it's pshat. And I'm going to tell you, I mean, I can read it, but the problem is that anything he would say, he'd convince you. And if I read to you what he says, that's it, you'll be convinced also. Yeah, you want to hear a little of it? It seems to me the real intent of the heavenly voice can be found in the different readings of the Talmud Bavli and Talmud Yerushalmi. How did the heavenly voice turn to the sinner? By what name did the voice call to him? By Elisha ben Avuya, his proper name, or by Acher, his pseudonym? The answer is plain. The soft, loving, spoken words of eternal backsliding children were certainly directed to Elisha ben Avuya. The heavenly voice called him, pleaded with him, drew him to itself. The divine presence pampered him like a mother who in all circumstances is good to save her child. The sharp, except for, was to Acher, but not to Elisha ben Avuya. Rabbi Soloveitchik, who was a brisker, that Sveidinim, there's two different things. The voice was saying two different things. It was saying Shuvah banim shovavim to Elisha ben Avuya, but it was saying to Acher, except for you. So he basically claims that he had some kind of religious schizophrenia. And therefore, there was a tzaddik called Elisha ben Avuya, who was a big Talmid Chacham, and there was a Rasha who was called Acher, and the tzaddik is told to come back home, and the Rasha is told to go away. And he misunderstood all of this because he's schizophrenic. And that's basically Rabbi Soloveitchik's interpretation. Yes, you like this or not? The treachery came about, and I'll go back before that. The true Tana, the sage of the sages of Israel, whose Torah Rebbe quotes in Pirkei Avot, never sinned. He was never traitorous to Klal Yisrael. He never joined the Romans. By the way, all this is not true. He did join the Romans. But he's saying, no, there's a tzaddik inside him who never did. Someone else was a traitor, another personality, Acher. The treachery came about in a strange way. One fine morning, Elisha ben Avuya did not recognize himself. He made a disastrous mistake about himself. A Gilgal, a dark, ugly soul entered within him, bewitched him, persuaded him that he was not a disciple of the sages of tradition, that he loathes all that is holy and that Knesset Yisrael is not his mother, that its future is not his future. Skipping a little bit, once on a Yom Kippur, it happened to fall in Shabbat, Acher lost his mind. He mounted his horse publicly and pranced swiftly through the areas populated by the Jews. The echoes of his prancing resounded through the empty streets of Israel's towns and cities. Jews looked with amazement through the windows of the Beit HaMidrash. They asked one another the identity of the arrogant disturber of the sacred peace of the Sabbath of Sabbaths. Suddenly something miraculous happened. Within the soul of the torn, tragic Tana, within his bewitched personality, Elisha ben Avuya stirred. The glorious soul which had slumbered within the depths of being awakened. It arose momentarily and thrust aside the hand of Acher to guide the horse toward the Holy of Holies. Why should he suddenly pass by the Holy of Holies riding his horse on Yom Kippur, which he was publicly desecrating? And he goes on to explain. Rabbi Soloveitchik uses this as a metaphor for all secular Jews in Israel. He says that secular Jews in Israel, also deep inside, they have an attraction to holiness, but they also hate holiness, but they're attracted to it. I'll tell you something fascinating. I've been living in Israel for 31 years. And in the neighborhood where we live, you have the people who come to shul on Yom Kippur, which are most of the same people that come all year round. You have a couple people who come who don't come all year round. And then you have a whole bunch of secular people who dress in white and stand outside the Beit Knesset. They can't bring themselves to walk in, but they stand outside. And in a sense, that's what he's disturbing. That's what Rabbi Soloveitchik is describing. There's a magnet pulling them to holiness, but they have a hard time walking in. And he uses this is Rabbi Soloveitchik's explanation, that Elisha ben Avuya, again, had this dichotomy within him, and part God was calling back and telling him, part was saying to go away. But I want to try to get to what I think is the proper answer. Elisha ben Avuya says to Rabbi Meir, and if I were to teshuva, would God accept me? I already heard, he answers his own question, I already heard God say, I don't want you. Now, if I was Rabbi Meir, And I've thought about this a lot. And Elisha ben Avuya says to me, I can't do tshuva. A voice came and said, I can't do it. And by the way, I agree with one thing with Rabbi Soloveitchik. I do believe he misunderstood the voice, and hopefully I won't forget that. But if I were Rabbi Meir, I would say to him, stop a second. Do you believe that doing tshuva is the right thing? Or do you believe killing other Jews is the right thing? Do you believe forcing people to break Shabbat is the right thing to do morally? Or do you believe that to follow the word of God is right? Because you're putting this whole thing not in terms of what is right and what is wrong and what is truth and what is not truth. And this whole issue becomes for you a personal issue. Is it worthwhile for me to do tshuva because God is not going to accept it anyway? Do you understand what I'm asking? If I were to be mayor, I'd say to him, this isn't your problem. Are you God's accountant to figure out, will he accept it, not accept it? If you think it's the right thing to do, then do tshuva. Say you're sorry. Say you're profoundly sorry. Say you went crazy, you did crazy things. Again, killing people is not a small thing. Forcing Jews to break Shabbat time, to break their spirit, is not a small thing. And if the whole reason you're doing this, not because you don't believe in it, but because you think that God's not going to accept you anyway, and basically say, well, if you're not going to accept me, then I'm not going to accept you. Do tshuva, and then give God a very big problem. Okay, God, what are you going to do now? I did tshuva, what are you going to do? And that's exactly what I'm saying. Just throw it right back at God. This is your problem now. That's what I would say if I was Rabbi Meir, and he would say, I can't. No, no one said you can't. What God said, and by the way, I want to be real careful, what actually did the Bat Kol say? Shuvu banim shovivim chutz mi'achir. Did that say that you can't do tshuva, or did that say something else? See, there's a beautiful Ramban. Let me ask you a question. This is a serious question. If you sin deliberately, saying to yourself, Yom Kippur's coming, how soon is Yom Kippur? 2 weeks, right? Yom Kippur's coming in a little less than 2 weeks. I may as well sin now, because I already have all day Yom Kippur with nothing else to do. You know, a lot of, you know, Ashamnu and Al Faith to do. I may as well sin now, because I have Yom Kippur coming. Is that good? Does that work?
No.
Yes or no?
No.
Why not? Because somebody told you that it doesn't work. Why doesn't it work? Because there's a Mishnah that says maybe it doesn't work. Here, listen to the Mishnah carefully, and then we're going to read the Rambam, because the Rambam is unbelievable. And the Rambam's our solution to this problem. Ha'omer echte ba'ashuv, echte ba'ashuv. Person says, I'm going to, puts on his calendar, what's today's day? September 10th. Puts down September 10th, 11 o'clock at night. Sin. Big letters. What color should we put them in? Red, obviously. Big red letters, sin. And then you put Yom Kippur. What do you write on it? Tshuva, and repeat hourly. Okay? You put this in your calendar. What does the Mishnah say? Ha'omer echte ba'ashuv, echte ba'ashuv. Ein maspikin biyadu lasot tshuva. You know what's great with that phrase? Ein maspikin biyadu lasot tshuva. Do you realize the problem? There are too many words. What should have it said? What should have it said? Tshuva ain't a mo'elet. Tshuva doesn't work. Ein maspikin biyadu lasot tshuva. It's too many words. Echte v'yom kippur mechaper. Ein yom kippur mechaper. Now listen to what the Rambam writes about this. Both of these phrases. Ha'omer echte v'ashuv echte v'ashuv. Ha'omer echte v'yom kippur mechaper. Ein yom kippur mechaper. K'mo amram. What does it mean? Ein maspikim yodah lasot tshuva. U'lefichach lo ya'azruhu Hashem she'yase b'tzom kippur mashira'ui lo lasot k'dei she'yitchapru lo avonotav b'otor yom. Did anybody catch what the Rambam said? The Rambam said that God is not going to help you. Any of you still write? You still write on paper? Now that you use computers?
Not
yours. Just the thing you'll be on Facebook all day? Okay. So, do you still write on the top of the page, Bet Samach Dalet, or?
Yeah.
Bet Hey? What does that mean, Bet Samach Dalet? Good. What does that mean? Besaita Dishmaya means with God's help. Besaita Be'ezrat Hashem. With the help of Be'ezrat Hashem, that God will help, God's help. What the Rambam is saying is that on Yom Kippur, God normally helps us. I gave a shiur last night in Kol Nidre. Kol Nidre is the silliest thing in the world. People walk into shul, the chazan starts saying kol nidre, they start crying. It's almost a meaningless prayer. Okay, I'm going to take away the nedr that I may or may not have said. But what is it? It's the very tunes of Yom Kippur help awaken within us something which is very, very deep. On Yom Kippur, we have, hopefully, we have sight to Shemayim. God helps us. Okay, I'm going to give a male-oriented example. You can switch it around. Let's say you have a young man who sinned all year, hung out with girls, fooled around, all kinds of things. But Yom Kippur, he's going to do tshuva. Puts it on his calendar. Walks into shul Yom Kippur. Mechitz is a little low. Who catches his eye? Some gorgeous girl over there, and he can't daven because she's looking at her the whole time. Do you realize what God did for him? He answered his prayers. But he answers his prayers for 364 days a year, but not his Yom Kippur prayers. But what did God really do just now? He didn't help him. He didn't give him sight to the Shmaya. He didn't help him, Yom Kippur, to do the words of the Rambam. He didn't help him do that which he needed to do on Yom Kippur. Normally, we need sight to the Shmaya. We need help. We need God to help us. What happens if I say, Echtav Ashuv, Echtav Ashuv? God is not going to call you in. He's not going to invite you through the door. He's not going to come and say, come. Now think about it. What do the Bat Kol say? Shuvu Banim Shovim. What does that mean? I am inviting all of you to come back. Chutz Me'achar. What does a Chutz Me'achar mean? It doesn't mean he can't do Shuvu. What does it mean? I'm not inviting you. And what if you burst through the door? One of the great Hasidic commentaries writes that everything the Baal HaBayit tells you to do, you should do except to leave. And he says, you shouldn't have listened. The Baal HaBayit can't tell you to leave. Kodesh Baruch Hu can't tell you to leave. Meaningless. Say, I'm staying. I'm not going anywhere. The point is, God never said you can't do tshuva, but he didn't go out to help him. Now, why didn't he go out to help him? And at this point is what I think is really the depth of the whole Gemara. What was his sin? His sin was, and again, I want you to be careful now. You can say, what was his sin? His sin was murder. His sin was causing people, it was Mesir Madiach, causing people to break Shabbat, and all kinds of... What was his sin? No limit of his sins. But what was the core of his sin? The core of his sin is a one-word answer, which doesn't sound all that bad, by the way. The one word is pragmatism. He was pragmatic. His whole involvement in Torah, what he tells us, was because his father told him, Torah has real power. So he was involved because of the power. It all worked until one day he woke up and he realized there's something more powerful than Jerusalem, and that's Rome. And the day he realized that Rome is more powerful than Jerusalem, what did he do? He said, I'm joining Rome. He gave up because of his pragmatism. And when Rabbi Meir says, come back, what does he say? But I won't be accepted. And I'm going to go back to what I said before. Who cares you're not going to be accepted? Is this true or is this not true? So what is his problem? It's pragmatism. And since the core of his sin is pragmatism, what does God say to him? Don't come back. Why? Because God didn't want him just to do tshuva for the sake of tshuva. God wants him to do tshuva from the core of his problem. For him to do real tshuva, what would he have had to do? To do tshuva from his pragmatism. Not what am I going to get out of this. Not what's going to help me more. But let him, for the first time in his life, do something which is true, because it's true. Because that's what real Avodat Hashem was. And that's what God is calling him to do. That's what God's calling him to do by telling him, don't bother doing it because you're not going to get anything out of it. So now the question is, you're going to do it anyway or you're not going to do it anyway? If he does it anyway, that's what real tshuva is. Which means God, even by telling Elisha ben Avuya not to come, is still helping him do tshuva in the deepest possible way. Now the question is, does he take it up or not? So then it depends on this, which end of the story, the end of the story in the Bavli, the end of the Yerushalmi. The end of the story in the Yerushalmi is that on his deathbed, Rav Meir is summoned. Rav Meir walks into the room, he finds him dying, and he says, do tshuva. And again he asks, will it help? And I'm not going to say word for word what he says, but basically Rav Meir says back to him, could it hurt? And he says that he starts to cry. And a tear comes down his cheek, and as the tear drips down his cheek, he dies. And Rav Meir is watching this and says, my Rebbe did tshuva. It's just an unbelievable ending to the story, and I'm going to stress it again, especially in the Yerushalmi, because in the Yerushalmi, he's such a wicked man who did so many bad things, and did all that he could to destroy the entire Jewish people. And it's almost like some of us should sit here and say, once you know the whole story, maybe God shouldn't let a person like this do tshuva. But I'm going to flip it around. If God is even going to engage a person like this, who's going to hear a bat kol, who's going to hear a voice by the Kodesh HaKadoshim saying, I want my children to come back. If God is even going to engage a person like this, even to tell him, but you don't bother, just so that he should try harder to do it, then all the more so, all of us who were raised in a very, very privileged way, who received a very special education, who have so many things going for us, all of us, when it comes to Rosh Hashanah, Aseret Yemei Teshuva, Yom Kippur, we all need to hear that voice and to know that's what God is saying to us. Shuvu banim shovavim. Despite all the things that we've done, God calls to us with a voice. And all of us hopefully have not been a cynic on Zalisha ben Avuya, and all of us are allowed to daven. You know what we daven for? We don't just daven that God accepts it. We daven, God give me sight to the Shemayim. God help me along the way. God help me daven. If you have a hard time davening, you daven to God, God help me daven. Don't you get it? You daven for the thing you really need. If davening is hard, please help me daven. And that suddenly becomes meaningful. God wants all of us, and all of you are young still, you don't know what it's like to be a parent, for those of us who are old, even grandparents, that there's nothing which is more important to us than to try to bring our children back, come home for the weekend, come home for Shabbat, come home for the holidays, come home to where you were brought up. That's what God wants us. Come back. And he calls us. He's calling us, come back. Can a person do tshuva? Absolutely. Can anybody do tshuva? Absolutely. Now, if I were to really want to quote Rabbi Soloveitchik, so it's very simple. The Rambam says everyone can do tshuva. It's a halacha. There's no exceptions to it. So of course everyone can do tshuva. But if you want to bring Elisha ben Avuya as the proof, virtually all the Bali Machshava say, of course he could have done tshuva. They have a problem. How do you understand the Bible? He made it up. He misunderstood it. It wasn't talking to him. It was talking to somebody else. Or, as I'm saying, the Bat Kol was there to say to him, not to invite him, never said. Again, it's a total misunderstanding to say that this Bat Kol said, you can't do tshuva. It said, everyone's invited, you're not invited. But just because you're not invited to a party, does that mean you can't crash? He could have crashed. He could have crashed and said, I'm here anyway, I'm doing tshuva. I'm sorry for being so pragmatic. I'm sorry for not believing in the Jewish people. I'm sorry for not believing in God sufficiently. And here I am, I'm back. God, you got a problem now. And what would God say? I have no problem whatsoever. Welcome home. Save the scene to us.